Price, that's the number one technical indicator.
You do best by investing for the longer term.
If you can't explain what the business is doing, then that is a huge red flag.
Some technological change is going to put you out of business.
It really is a genuinely extraordinary situation.
Welcome back. I'm Hayden Brain, and you're listening to Opto Sessions, where we interview the top traders and investors from around the world, uncovering their secrets to success. Michael A. Guyard is portfolio manager at Toroso Investments, a company with $5 billion AUM. Michael manages Toroso's ATAC rotation fund, which has returned roughly 50% this year, an extremely impressive result amid unprecedented market volatility. Michael is also the co-author of 4 award-winning research papers on market anomalies and investing, an active contributor to MarketWatch and Seeking Alpha, and has been interviewed on CNBC, Bloomberg, and the Wall Street Journal Live. Michael has a truly unique approach to interpreting market movements, which is chronicled in his daily output on the critically acclaimed Lead Lag Report. It's Michael's tactical risk-on, risk-off strategy that we focus on during the interview. It's not one to miss. Welcome to the podcast, Michael. It's great to have a chance to speak to you. It's a volatile time for markets. Have you been keeping busy?
That's one way to put it. You know, when I was on the road doing presentations, I'd always, at CFA chapters, when it was in the low volatility period, tell the audience, you know, all of you love low volatility, but you get pretty bored and not that busy when you're trying to build a business and you're comparing you against Vanguard, because that's what everybody wants in a low vol environment. When volatility picks up is when you get busy and when you start to actually grow in many ways. So certainly been super busy the last several months here.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, it's been even just from the content side, obviously Opto produces daily news on the market, and we've been kept extremely busy by how fast moving the markets and stocks are, more specifically. So I want to get straight into the interview. You're responsible for the critically acclaimed Lead Lag report. So firstly, what sets us apart from other investment reports or content more generally?
So I think where a lot of other research tries to position itself is around upside and around trying to find the next hot stock or the next hot sector, focusing more on the up capture part of the equation, whereas everything I do is really around risk off and downside, under the idea that that's really where most outperformance can kind of kick in. So, you know, I don't try to present what I do from the perspective of this is, you know, how you're going to really, you know, kill it in the stock market when the market's going up. It's really more about how do you avoid getting killed when the market goes down? How do you identify the conditions under which accidents occur? How do you do it objectively, quantitatively? Because at the end of the day, the downside matters a lot more than the upside.
Yeah, okay, absolutely. So I saw on your website that you actually specify who this content is relevant for. And you suggest it's for the intelligent investor rather than, for example, you know, day traders, people looking for sort of short-term returns on a single bet, for example. So in your eyes, what makes an intelligent investor?
Well, I mean, and that's not to disparage, of course, the day traders or the like, right? I think when I refer to intelligence, I'm referring to system 2 of the brain, right? Meaning the idea of not reacting, not being emotional, not chasing, and kind of being more objective and, you know, putting the effort into thinking about where we are in the cycle, where we are in the environment, and where are conditions likely to lead to probabilities that favor an outcome. So, you know, there's two sides to this business of investing, right? There's the emotional short term, and hopefully there's the more intellectual long term. The intellectual long term is what tries to avoid the noise of what happens, you know, day to day. I think the emotional tends to sort of tune in more to that. So I'm trying to focus more on the signal, not the noise. You tend to have more signal longer term, which requires, I think, a degree of you know, rational thought and analysis, as opposed to the FOMO, fear of missing out phenomenon, which is very real. And I think gets people into trouble more often than not when those big declines obviously happen.
Yeah, absolutely. We've probably seen a lot of that lately as well, with the amount of volatility in the markets.
Okay, well, so there's some really interesting stuff there. And I want to come back to the lead lag report specifically a bit further down in the interview. But if we can just pause there and focus on your background, I want to dig into this just for people that are less familiar with your work. So first of all, you wrote the foreword for your father's book, Intermarket Analysis and Investing, Integrating Economic, Fundamental and Technical Trends. A valuable read for our listeners. I had a quick read of a few chapters before our call today. Really enjoyed it. But first of all, perhaps you can tell us, or tell the listeners even, what the book's really about.
Sure. So, you know, a lot of people are probably familiar with the term intermarket analysis from the works of John Murphy, who is a very well-known sort of, you know, technician that looks at the interplay of asset classes to each other. So I kind of have a long history in the realm of investing, in the sense that my father in the late 80s had worked alongside Bob Farrell at Merrill Lynch. Bob Farrell, you know, maybe a name not familiar with a lot of listeners, but Bob Farrell was sort of this legendary technician in the late 80s before you could, with the click of a mouse, overlay and to see moving average crossovers. There were guys like Bob Farrell that would do this stuff by hand and had a lot of sort of broader macro thoughts. So my father worked on his team and, you know, wrote two books on markets. One titled The Challenge of a Generation, which looked at what happened with the 87 stock market crash that my father, you know, had thought would happen prior to it occurring. And then that book, they referenced Intermarket Analysis and Investing. Now, that's a book that my father wrote in 1990. It was a very limited run. Never really kind of got much traction from the publisher, but, you know, was sort of in many ways the foundation for my own thinking that led to even the creation of the signals that go into the ATAC rotation mutual fund I run, the ATAC US rotation ETF that I run, and these various white papers that I won awards on. I republished the book in 2013 in his memory. He passed away in 08. I got the rights to the book back. Wrote the foreword, and even though it's, you know, 30 years old or so, it still has very strong reviews and it's still very applicable, I think, to the environment here. But taking a step back, you know, when I talk about intermarket analysis, really what I'm referring to is the interplay of asset classes and sectors to each other. It's really sort of a way of looking at markets from a relative perspective. It's a branch of technical analysis whereby what you're looking at matters in comparison to something else. So technical analysis tends to look at a price chart in isolation, meaning a true technician really shouldn't care if it's a stock, if it's a bond, if it's Tesla, if it's Apple. It's just price behavior. Intermarket analysis says that what you're looking at matters and that the interplay of certain parts of the investable landscape might show you the whites of the eyes of some kind of regime change to come. So the classic intermarket relationship is that of oil prices to bonds, right? So as oil prices rise, you would expect the bond yields should also rise. Why? Because oil is a form of cost push inflation. And as oil goes, so too should inflation premiums, which bond investors then should want more yield for. So that's sort of a classic relationship. But yeah, the idea is really to sort of get a sense of this relative movement and see if there's some information you can glean from it to then make your investing decisions.
Yeah, great. We'll talk a little bit further down about how that sort of top-down approach or that intermarket approach impacts the investing and the comp that you're producing at the moment. But first of all, if we could focus on the key investment lessons, I suppose, you get from the book, or maybe actually what's more interesting is the key investment lessons that were passed down from your father to you. Is there any that you could pick out that are still very applicable today in today's market?
You know, it's interesting. I have this old clip that I converted into like a, you know, from a VHS tape of my father doing a discussion, a presentation with other Merrill Lynch brokers where he was the speaker. And one of the clips had my father talking about the Fed, where he's talking about interest rates. And in that clip, he tells this audience of brokers at Merrill Lynch
you want an instant depression, raise interest rates to 10%, 15%. This is back in the late 80s. He said, you want one of the greatest bull markets of all time, push interest rates to negative 25%. He said, you get one of the most incredible runs you've ever seen in equities, but that'll be at the cost of inflation. So I think, you know, even back then when the Federal Reserve arguably was not anywhere near as active as the Fed is now, the idea that the Fed can really drive conditions with their policies has permeated, right, throughout many, many decades. It's not just a new phenomenon. The fact that it's known that the Fed can manipulate the markets even back 30 years ago before QE, I think is quite telling.
Yeah, absolutely. Some really poignant points that very much relate to today's environment, even sort of 20, 30 years ago, as you say there. So yeah, that's some really fascinating insight. And then I guess let's move on then to, you mentioned briefly your management of the ATAC rotation fund. So this is for a company called Tarosso Asset Management, I believe. So firstly, can you just discuss your duties for Tarosso? What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's quite a few things we do. So at Tarosso, we manage about $5 billion in assets across those we advise to and those that we have direct discretion over. I run the ATAC Rotation Mutual Fund, which is a risk-on, risk-off mutual fund using the behavior of utilities and treasuries to help navigate conditions that favor higher or lower stock market volatility by going risk-on into equities or risk on into treasuries. You know, thankfully, that strategy, which is really meant to be as tactical as you can imagine, has had quite a strong year. Year to date, as of this conversation, you know, mid-November or so, is it's up roughly 50% for the year, largely because the predictive indicators used in the mutual fund, which are documented in these papers I put together, got ahead of the COVID crash and then went risk on into equities coming out of it. So kind of got both sides of the extreme correct. I recently launched an exchange-traded fund using a different type of signal and a different set of opportunity, a different opportunity set called the ATAC US Rotation ETF. The ticker on that is RORO, which I'm still amazed we got risk on, risk off. That uses the behavior of lumber to gold to allocate to either risk on U.S. small caps and Russell growth or risk off long duration treasuries. But, you know, we try to, as a firm, I think, differentiate ourselves as being, you know, true ETF experts. Even my mutual fund trades around ETFs. And also in terms of recognizing that, you know, the harsh reality is that you have to really manage risk and not return. And unfortunately, I think too many in this industry focus on return and not risk. We take, I think, a very different approach to that, which has served us really quite well this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, in the ETF, just before we move on, that's the ETF available globally here in the UK as well. Is that right?
It should be, right. So anybody, as I understand it, it should be pretty much available anywhere. So with a mutual fund, you have to be a US investor, have a US account. Because it's an ETF, it's tradable anywhere. So that ETF tracks an index that we created with Market Vectors called the ATAC Risk On, Risk Off Domestic Index. So it's designed to track this very active rules-based index. It's fairly remarkable because the risk on, risk off signals are quite telling and quite strong, especially when you get the risk off right. The nature of the approach is that it more likely than not underperforms in unrelenting bull markets, but you know, typically all the alpha really comes from those big declines. It kind of goes back to that point that I kind of made my life hard by focusing more on the risk off than the risk on side. But certainly has an interesting, as an index at least, return profile correlation is pretty much zero over time against equities, even though it's rotating risk on, risk off into equities or treasuries.
Yeah, that is interesting. Okay, so one for the listeners to go away and look at. And just before we move on, it's interesting to me that I suppose this sort of risk first, more tactical approach and more nimble approach is consistent, I suppose, both in the work you're doing at Tirosso, but also on the lead lag report. Having read some of the content that you're putting out there, you know, it's very much, there's a very similar sort of strategy in mind when you're putting that content out as well. So I guess what came first? Is it a philosophy that you've sort of honed over time? How did it come to be?
You know, it's interesting. I haven't really sort of thought about where that comes from, except that, you know, aside from sort of the math of you know, the downside versus the upside, I mean, the quintessential example, of course, is, you know, you go down 50%, you have to double to break even, right? Everyone always references that, but I don't think people really understand how challenging that is. I think for me, what really sort of solidified the thinking was really around the work of Nassim Taleb, you know, who authored The Black Swan. And one of these lines that he's known for saying is, history doesn't crawl, it jumps. And markets crawl up, right? They jump off a cliff when they go down, right? So because, you know, very big declines can have such dramatic impacts on total return, I became, you know, somewhat obsessed with the idea of, well, you know, even though I may not know the mile marker I'm going to crash my car, let me focus on the weather. Let me focus on the conditions that favor the accident. And, you know, that really sort of, you know, hit me quite a bit in 07, 08. So, you know, I was running a very small hedge fund at the time as the financial crisis was just kind of unfolding. And it became very clear to me that, you know, you could have a few weeks that could just erase many, many years of performance. Everyone gets sucked into the consistency of the upside, not with the magnitude of the downside until it's too late. So kind of living through it, you know, kind of being influenced by, you know, tail risk thinking through the works of Taleb, you know, that became a map for me to try to create a quantitative mindset with which everything since then has really kind of been a derivative of.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, that feels pretty apparent in the work you're doing on the lead lag report. So maybe that's the perfect juncture to talk about that. On your website, you promote a tactical data-driven approach. Perhaps you can just explain a little bit more in terms of what you mean by that.
So look, you know, I used to do a lot of the media runs, meaning I used to, you know, be on the CNBCs of the world, the Bloombergs of the world, and kind of do the punditry thing for a while. And, you know, partially you have to kind of do that because it gets your name out there, right? I mean, it is a form of branding and marketing, I think, in general. But the reality is most things that people talk about or refer in the media have no predictive power. Most people will say something with tremendous confidence, but when you actually test what they're saying, it doesn't hold water. And all I'm trying to do ultimately is give voice to math. I'm looking at very quantitative, objectively tested indicators, and I'm basically trying to provide a narrative around the data, because the reality is if you simply talk numbers all day, you're not going to grab attention. You're not going to hold one's focus. So you've got to provide some kind of story around the numbers. But all I do is do that, right? Just kind of give voice to that math. There are very few things that have predictive power. I know because I've tested a lot of different things, you know, over many, many years, you know, just in terms of backtesting. The thing which arguably has anything that tends to have sort of any kind of link to inflationary fear or deflationary fear tends to have some degree of predictive power, which is why the papers that I co-authored that won these different awards focused on interest rate sensitive areas, utilities, treasuries, lumber relative to gold. It's all kind of tracking the same concept. So from a data-driven perspective, it's not about trying to provide interesting data points that, yeah, it might be great if you're on Jeopardy, but may not matter in terms of actual asset allocation or trading. I'm trying to focus on things that actually likely drive various asset classes. And admittedly, right, there's not that many of them. I mean, that's what's always remarkable to me is that you have a very limited set of true leading indicators that might provide some information you can take advantage of. So markets, I would argue, are still reasonably efficient, but those which actually, you know, have that predictive power are few and far between, and that's what I try to highlight the most.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, perhaps you could give us an example that makes it I don't know, like a little bit less abstract for the listener. So is there a market where you could pick out an indicator that is predictive, or at least, you know, partially gives you a sense of where that market's headed? Is there one example that sort of springs to mind?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll use the one that won the 2015 NAME Founders Award. And all these papers are publicly available on the Social Science Research Network, SSRN.com. But what that paper documents is the predictive power of lumber prices relative to gold. Mm-hmm. So as it relates to stocks and bonds. Now, on the surface, that sounds like a strange concept. Why would I want to look at two seemingly unrelated commodities as a tell for equities and for treasuries? Well, the link is really around housing, right? So lumber, typically when lumber is strong, that's a reflection of housing construction and demand coming, right, on the home front, right? And because most U.S. consumer wealth is not in the stock market, it's their homes, as lumber goes, that tends to mean that housing is about to pick up, and housing itself is a leading indicator for the economy. Mm-hmm. So when lumber is strong, that tends to mean you have lower S&P 500 volatility going forward. Conversely, when gold does well, that tends to portend higher risk going forward. Why? Because gold is more of a risk-off play when you have these extraordinary volatility periods that are coming. So the idea is that you compare a very cyclical commodity with lumber to gold, which is not cyclical. And what ends up happening is it tells you something about stock risk, right, going forward. So, and this is an indicator that's used explicitly in the ATAC US Rotation ETF, the RORO ticker I mentioned. So if lumber is outperforming gold, you go risk on. If gold is outperforming lumber, you go risk off. And what's remarkable about that research is that whether it's the 1987 crash, the 1990 housing recession, 2000, 2001, 2002, right before Lehman 2008, right before the summer crash of 2011, and just as the COVID crash was starting this year, in all of those extreme cases, lumber underperformed gold before those declines happened. So there was something about that relationship which in extremes got ahead of it, right, before it was too late, which again goes back to risk off and the exact mile marker. You might crash your car, you just need to see the conditions as told by these intermarket relationships. It's very, it's always remarkable to me how that plays out. Now, there's an important thing to think about when you're looking at indicators like that, which is that, you know, it's not like every time lumber is weak relative to gold, you are going to have a crash. Just like every time you drive entering a storm is not a guarantee that you're going to have a crash. It just means the conditions favor it, right? And that's always the tricky thing, I think, from a tactical perspective, which is the idea that because we live in the small sample, if your signal is wrong in the small sample, you think that the signal's broken. So even if you're in a false positive, it may be that it may be a false positive this time, but when it works in a really big way. So you have to kind of keep on playing defense along the way because you don't know when that storm actually does result in the crash you're trying to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the question that springs to mind then, and it's something you mentioned on your website, is this a strategy or is this a concept that I suppose outperforms in times of high volatility? Is that when we get the biggest indication that this is a worthwhile, this is a positive strategy to use?
So generally, I mean, and this is the thing, right? So it's really about trying to get ahead of the volatility, right? Because I think the issue with a lot of active and sort of tactical traders in general is that they tend to react to a VIX spike. They get defensive after the fact, right? They fix the roof after it's rained. This is meant to try to anticipate the environment under which you're likely to have that potential tail, right? So, and that's a really important, different way of thinking about managing risk, right? Rather than trying to react after the risk is kind of manifesting, it's try to get ahead of it, because especially if you're going into treasuries in advance of what could be a high risk period, if the high risk period comes, you know, treasuries as a risk off play tend to make money, meaning yields go down during the flight to safety moment as stocks themselves go down. So now you're not only preserving capital, you're actually kind of making money, you know, more often than not playing risk off in treasuries, meaning you've got more capital to compound off of, so that when you rotate back risk on, when the conditions favor lower stock market volatility, that's how you, from a compounding perspective, have a very strong year. That's why my own mutual fund has done what it's done. The ATAC rotation mutual fund being up 50% is not because it was taking on more risk. It was that it was avoiding the decline, making money in treasuries in advance, positioning there, the accident happens, and then went, sped up after sort of the accident and crash passes. I mean, that's why I like the driving analogy so much. It's funny, I never even thought about this until now. You know, it's kind of like after you have a period where everyone's rubbernecking, or after a period where everyone is slowing down because of a crash and it's a lot of traffic, the moment you pass the crash, it's free and clear. You can speed as fast as you want, right? There's not that many cars in front of you. So it does kind of go back to this point that, you know, you have to manage volatility before the volatility hits. Otherwise, you know, you take a very big hit, it's too late, and then, you know, it results in suboptimal decision making because most people then de-risk at the exact wrong time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that listening to you, I'm comparing it in my head to more of a passive buy and hold strategy, I suppose. And it seems to, you know, it's not the opposite of it, but it certainly is a more active way of approaching the markets and dealing with your investment. So,
yeah. And by the way, on that point, right, to me, the joke about buy and hold is that very few people actually hold.
Yeah.
Which actually is probably why it works, right? In other words, you know, when you look at the average holding period for a mutual fund, it used to be, you know, 4 years. Now, you know, the estimates are somewhere between 9 and 10 months for average stocks. It's about 4 or 5 months. I think it's actually shorter than all that, right? So buy and hold is I think in many ways a myth for the vast majority of people, which is also why it works, right? Because if you need to have lack of a belief in a strategy for the strategy to keep working. Otherwise, the strategy's effectiveness gets arbitraged away, right? And by the way, you know, on buy and hold, I always used to kind of use this example on the road. You know, some people don't like active strategies or back tests or anything that kind of focuses on some degree of mining the past in terms of relationships. Yet, you know, when I was at CFA chapters doing presentations, you know, all the papers I've co-authored that won these different awards are based on back tests. Whatever's in the lead lag report is based on back tests. And yeah, I would always ask the audience, you know, I'd say, well, how many of you don't believe in backtesting? And I'd get half the audience raising their hand, saying they don't believe in backtesting as a way of, you know, conducting an investment strategy. I would then ask the audience after that, well, how many of you believe in buy and hold? And the other half of the audience would raise their hand, believing that, you know, saying that they believe in buy and hold. And I would then, of course, you know, kind of pause and then say, so I guess all of you believe in backtesting, right? Because buy and hold is also a backtest. It's a backtest with one trade, but it's still nonetheless a backtest, right? And I think that's also an important thing to remember, right? Buy and hold is a strategy. Active is a strategy. Factor-based investing is a type of a strategy based on certain anomalies that persist over time. Diversification comes from strategies, not from asset classes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like theoretically a buy and hold strategy might work. But as you say, in reality, no one would actually hold consistently for the long term. You know, everyone is more active than they probably care to admit, I suppose. It's interesting. It's got me thinking about my own investments, I suppose. Before we move on to the lead lag report, how can people subscribe? Like, how can people get access to this content that you're putting out?
Yeah, sure. No, I appreciate that. So on, and first of all, you know, if anyone's curious to kind of follow me on Twitter, it's at Lead Lag Report. The premium research service is at leadlagreport.com. I'll throw it out there. If you use promo code LEADLAG30, capital L on the lead and capital L on the lag, you get 30% off, you know, for whatever it's worth. But, you know, again, my objective in the research is to try to offer something different, right? It's funny, even when it relates to the ETF, you know, recently launched, which is risk on, risk off in a variation, I had somebody saying, in looking at the index, it looks like you cracked the code to beating the stock market. And I didn't crack the code to anything except being different, right, than the stock market. And I think hopefully anybody that subscribed kind of can appreciate that idea of being different. That's really what I want to get across.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great. Well, we're going to return to some of those concepts anyway. But I have some questions here around some specific sectors. We won't spend too long on it. But I just was interested, having read a couple of your recent articles on Seeking Alpha. So a lot of your content is available there as well. I've read a few articles before the call today. The first of which was where you analysed the healthcare sector, or the Vanguard Healthcare ETF, more specifically. So it's obviously a sector in the spotlight at the moment with coronavirus, and the tailwind there essentially is the virus, given the response needed from that sector. However, I wonder whether you think there are any growth drivers in that sector, or for that sector, that would suggest this trend is one that might continue into next year and beyond, perhaps.
So I think the where it gets to be interesting with healthcare in particular, and you know, healthcare is a broad term, right? When you look at a sector in general, so obviously these broad-based sector ETFs, you know, they're not sort of trying to, you know, dig down into where the real serious growth drivers are. We all know what the growth drivers are, and it's beyond COVID. I mean, healthcare as a general sector is needed, because the reality is, you know, you still have the demographics against you, right? So no matter what, you know, you're going to have more demand for healthcare, even if everyone is suddenly, you know, magically immune to COVID, right? Now, where there is some, I think, interesting focus that one could put on is in sort of the healthcare technology side of things, right? Because as, you know, as technology permeates the world, it's obviously permeated as well in the healthcare space. And actually, from everything I've seen, even this potential vaccine from Pfizer seems to be almost very largely technologically driven. Mm. Yeah, I think that part, that it seems to me that it makes sense that you're going to see a lot more investor demand and interest in sort of the technology aspect of the healthcare industry, whether it's for vaccine development or for things around stem cells or anything around just sort of a better quality of life and having technology to sort of help with that. So, The I think it's an interesting play in general. I think that there's still a lot more room to go there, because it's not just a COVID play. And, you know, to the extent that you might have some, you know, further sort of government money being thrown at healthcare because of COVID and through distributional stuff, everything that's going on, you know, as far as stay at home, is resulting in not just sort of infrastructure changes on technology overall, but also in terms of healthcare distribution. I mean, you're seeing that even here in the States, where, you know, there are advertisements for companies that are offering even, you know, doing blood tests at home, right, that then get mailed out instead of going to a lab. So there's a lot of interesting changes, I think, that are happening, which are quite exciting from a longer term perspective, different from, again, the tactical way of looking at markets. But yeah, that's certainly a sector that I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted to get your thoughts on just a theme that we're seeing amongst probably more retail traders, but some institutions are certainly doing it as well. And that is that they're betting or putting their kind of investment capital behind vaccine production, and more specifically, you know, companies that are there to produce that successful vaccine candidate, Pfizer, you mentioned one earlier. For me, as a theme, I guess it feels quite speculative, you know, hoping that you're going to be behind the winner in that space seems speculative to me anyway. But what's your take on that?
Yeah, and I think it's also about the margin, right? I mean, you know, it's not just a sort of a function of, okay, well, you know, Pfizer or Moderna is going to have a vaccine and they're going to make money hand over fist because it's going to be all government paid. Well, maybe, but I mean, it could also end up not being a very profitable vaccine because, you know, maybe they have to make it super affordable, right? So I mean, that's kind of the thing, right? To your point, there's the immediate reaction, the emotional aspect of, okay, chase whatever company of the moment is announcing some new phase trial or some new vaccine development and buy it with reckless abandon, because the thinking is that's going to directly translate to earnings. It may not have as big of an impact as the initial pricing of that stock might suggest, right, in general. That's not to say it can't go up, right? It's just to say that it kind of goes back to system one versus system two. You still need a little bit more analysis rather than just this kind of immediate visceral reaction that anything that has anyone that has a COVID vaccine is going to benefit wildly. There are still a lot of unknowns with this, Aside from the fact that, you know, it's going to be hard to distribute the vaccine, it doesn't seem to me, from everything I've looked at, that it's clear how long it lasts, which kind of makes sense, right? Because all this is relatively new and you need some time to develop data to see how time impacts efficacy. So I still think there's a lot of questions around this. And look, the reality is, you know, there's a vaccine. It's not going to be widely available to everybody right away. They're not going to be able to suddenly turn on a billion plus vaccines for the world, even if it was perfectly distributed. So, you know, I'm kind of with you on this idea that I think there's just a speculative fervor when you hear this kind of news. When you kind of step back, you know, and start analyzing, I think it's a lot murkier from an investment perspective, at least for that as a catalyst to buy a particular company.
We hope you're enjoying the episode. For interviews like this every Thursday, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, make sure you give us a star rating and leave guest suggestions along with any other feedback in the review section. Now, back to the show.
Let's get back to kind of your more top-down approach, your risk-on, risk-off approach. Because before we move on to a second sector that's kind of caught my eye, it's interesting to me to maybe understand whether it's possible to utilize your approach through the prism of a more sector-led, top-down perspective. So are you able to consider asset allocation between sectors with the lead lag or with the Tarosso approach? Like, are those two principles and philosophies that marry up or not?
So the answer is yes and no. So here's what I mean by that. So, you know, I announced recently, with my friends David Deerking and Matthew Bowler, you know, we all collectively co-authored this new white paper that won the 2020 Founders Award from NAME. And it's amazing. Actually, that paper was put together in Thanksgiving of last year during, you know, late November. But because of COVID, they delayed the announcement. So I finally kind of found out almost a year later that among, I think it was 29 papers, you know, this paper was viewed as the strongest in terms of its findings. But what that paper basically documents is sector allocation from a risk-on, risk-off extreme perspective, meaning where does it make sense to allocate to from a sector perspective based on certain VIX levels or VIX ranges in general. And typically what you end up finding is that in low volatility, average low VIX environments, you don't really sort of have that much of a way of allocating to sectors in a way that gets you more upside. So instead, you're actually better off being defensive at low volatility sort of junctures, because the idea is that if you have a low volatility juncture, if you're overweighted in defensive sectors like utilities, like healthcare, like consumer staples, that whenever you have a VIX spike, you're obviously now positioned into lower beta areas to begin with, so you're not going to be down as much. However, in extraordinary VIX spikes, where the VIX is, you know, greater than 32 as a level, what ends up happening is you have an overreaction to cyclical sectors of the stock market, like tech, like financials, like industrials, like materials. In other words, you end up having a more aggressive relative to the historical beta of cyclical sectors at the extremes of volatility. So what that paper basically documents is this idea that the best thing you can do, I think, from a sector allocation perspective is wait for the extremes, and rather than get defensive when the VIX is high, actually get as aggressive as possible by overweighting cyclicals when the VIX is high, which is basically just another way of saying buy extremely depressed, you know, sectors of the stock market when they're a lot lower, which is why the VIX would be higher to begin with. When you do that type of a sector positioning strategy, where you're overweighting aggressively cyclicals in the midst of an extraordinary high volatility period, you end up having much better risk-adjusted returns longer term. So kind of a long-winded answer, but the reality is when you think about sectors, the biggest dispersions come at the extremes of volatility. The argument of the paper is that's exactly when you'd want to take on the most risk, as you can imagine, you know, within your risk tolerance, obviously, in those sectors which have just gotten overly destroyed in the midst of those big declines.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wonder then, at the fund where we have seen some extremes in the market, whether that be, I don't know, the March sell-off, for example. Is that an extreme that you could have used as a pivot point to rotate out of certain sectors? Is that something that you adopted in the fund yourself?
Well, so I mean, so in the mutual fund and the ETF, it doesn't have sort of a sector component to it, but I did do that testing. You know, you would have been, you know, obviously with hindsight, because the market had a huge run off of the low, you would have been, you know, sitting nicely if you just overweighted aggressively cyclicals when the VIX crossed, you know, above 32. The problem is the VIX then went to 80, right? So my point in saying that is it works, you know, at least historically longer term, but in the midst of it, it's very hard to say to yourself, you know what, the world looks like it's ending. Let me go into the most cyclically sensitive growth areas of the stock market when the world looks like it's ending.
Yes.
Right? Because the world ended up looking like it was going to be ending even more after you hit a VIX level of 32 or so, which is what's documented in the paper as a trigger point. Which, by the way, is another reason why I think this stuff tends to work longer term, because it's hard. Right? It's the natural tendency when you're in the midst of a volatility spike is to de-risk.
Yeah.
Right? This is advocating actually take on more risk.
Mm. Yeah, it's almost sort of counterintuitive, I suppose. I do want to discuss, I guess, one other sector, and simply because, again, I read a piece on Seeking Alpha that you'd written, and it got me thinking about semiconductors. It's the topic of a recent podcast that we did with a Janus Henderson portfolio manager by the name of Denny Fish. He manages the technology fund there, or the technology portfolio there. And he was also quite bullish on the sector. So firstly, from your perspective, are there any macro factors at play driving such sort of positive sentiment here? You know, I can't seem to find too many that are bearish on the sector. So why is everyone so positive on semis right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the obvious answer would be it's obviously sort of this acceleration of technology, because we were all forced to kind of stay at home with COVID, right? It's just, you know, everyone suddenly starts upgrading, you know, doing an upgrade cycle, but instead of doing it at their office, they're doing it at their home, right? So you kind of, I think, kind of got ahead of a larger sort of wave that was happening. It just got compressed, and that has driven demand for semis in general, right? Semis, yeah, it's actually pretty remarkable, because they kind of kept in line with the S&P as things were collapsing, and then just pulled away very aggressively. Coming out of, you know, the low and sort of the initial as the initial reopening talks were starting in May, June, right? So now the question, of course, is you know you said something which is what gives me pause. As much as I'm bullish on it, the fact that everyone else is bullish on it automatically, right, gives me a little bit of, that makes my contrarian signals kind of go up a little bit. And what I would say about that is, you know, I think the space probably still has a lot of fundamental room to grow. The question for investors is always if the price is now kind of discounted all the possible good news, right? And that's always what's tricky when it comes to investing, because, you know, if everyone knows that, you know, technology, stay at home, semiconductor side, everyone knows that these areas are the place to be. The problem with that is then the payout gets split among so many different players betting on the same space that you don't have that same asymmetric huge return potential like you did, you know, a year ago, right? So and listen, I mean, you know, maybe even related to this, right? If you do see a broader shift stylistically from growth to value, which everyone's been waiting on for forever, at the margin, that means that technology and semis may be a source of funds taking away from the growth style to tilt more towards value, towards financials, towards energy, towards materials, which actually have been showing some renewed strength. So even though the industry of semis could be still strong from a fundamental perspective, the flow of funds may actually, you know, mean that most of the alpha might already be done with. right? And that maybe you're actually better off somewhere else from a contrarian perspective.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That value trend is interesting at the moment. Something that we've covered on Opto actually in our daily newsletter. Just to stick with semis for one more question. Within the iShares Semiconductor Sector Index ETF, the one that you profile again in your Seeking Alpha article, it was interesting to me that that fund was quite heavily skewed towards chip makers. With the top 10 making up over 60% of the portfolio. Why do you think this is?
Well, I don't know if that's sort of a phenomenon that's just for that index, right? I mean, we're in a world where increasingly more and more ETFs and more indices are being driven by just a very select group of stocks in general. Mm. I mean, part of it's kind of a bigger discussion around sort of the, more and more we're going away from industries having a lot of players to, an equivalent wealth gap between, a select 10 and everybody else in that index or in that ETF, right? There's kind of a broader discussion around sort of this winner-take-all environment that's happening, I think, across the board in pretty much every industry.
Yeah.
So that sort of weighting is not that big of a surprise, right? Because, look, there are natural advantages to being big and staying big, mm-hmm. right? So, and I do think that because of the proliferation of ETFs, what ends up happening is because most ETFs are market cap weighted, the largest companies that are market cap, that are market cap weighting these indices and these ETFs end up naturally getting more flows because people think in terms of themes, okay, semis. So just going to, a semi ETF. Well, that then means automatically those big companies get bigger, right? Because that's they're bigger weighting, right? So I don't think that's sort of that big of a surprise. I think in general, there is more concentration risk across the board in terms of looking at 10 stocks that might drive something than just in, this subgroup.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're seeing that across the board, regardless or irrespective almost of sector. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So rather than, I was going to ask you for a kind of pick, a sector to watch, but actually, I mean, kind of over the course of the discussion, it might be more interesting to discuss whether you think there's a specific market indicator, so something like the Lombard-Gold relationship and dynamic that you spoke about earlier, that our listeners should be sort of paying attention to and looking out for, over the next course, over the next couple of months, for example.
So I think, one of the things that's kind of quietly happening, which you're not really seeing a lot of, I think, coverage on, is there is this very real trend in outperformance that may still be very early in commodity plays, right? So when you look at the materials sector, right, against the broader S&P, that's showing some really interesting renewed strength, right? And while the media is focusing more on the energy sector, given how bombed out that sector has been, the broader material sector in general, really since March relative to the market, has been generating quite a bit of alpha. And I think that there may be some betting that's happening here that it's beyond a manufacturing recovery. I think there's some betting happening that we're going to finally see some real infrastructure spend.
Yeah.
Not just in the United States, but I think globally. Now, everyone always focuses on the US for the infrastructure, but it's a sort of a natural way of getting, the population to work, right? And let's face it, the reality is debt doesn't seem to matter to most governments, if any.
Yeah.
So, especially in the United States, where you have $27 trillion of debt and the Federal Reserve is literally just printing dollars to fund it. So you might as well throw another several trillion at infrastructure and materials, should benefit from that. So I do think that there's this kind of interesting theme or shift in cycle that we may start to see where you are going to see commodity prices rally, the stocks related to those commodities be more of a place to allocate to, which has other implications, by the way, on a lot of these indicators like lumber and gold, which probably also continues to be on average risk on and strong, and also has implications on the yield curve and bonds, right? So it goes back to that intermarket relationship of oil prices, when they rise, cost push inflation, that should result in bond yields rising as well. If you have some real movement in the commodity space, and I'm not talking about a super cycle like we, you know, we're used to with China, you know, many, many years ago. I'm talking about just some kind of marginal demand going on there that is going to help the Fed out, meaning that's going to help the Fed in terms of forcing inflation expectations into the system, because it means raw material prices are now increasing, which ultimately get passed down in some way, shape, or form, you know, across the economy. So that to me is intriguing, right? Because I think that has all kinds of other implications, right? It probably means emerging markets start to run because there's a link to commodities with emerging markets. It probably means that financials start to run because financials, while they are not as sensitive to the yield curve as they used to be, you have a steepening yield curve because of that inflationary pressure coming from commodities. That's still the margin going to help financials. Right. So I think there is sort of this broader sort of way of looking at markets here, which materials seem to be suggesting is possible, where you're entering a new phase of, you know, this bull environment where you are going to see a real shift to reflationary plays.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And do we think that's going to happen over the next couple of months, as I said, or is it a bit longer term than that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, that's the thing about cycle changes, right? You don't know if it's changed until 2 or 3 years after it's already changed. So it could be in the next several months. I mean, I think it's plausible, independent of, you know, whether it's Biden or even if it is somehow Trump, with, even though it's low probability, if either way, I think that dynamic is there. And again, I go back to, it's not just a U.S. Phenomenon, right? So if you look, a lot of big allocations typically occur at the start of the year in general by institutions. So if at the margin there are a lot of institutions that are starting to believe that is a possible theme, yeah, you probably would start to see some pretty aggressive positioning there just because it's the start of 2021.
Yeah, great. Okay, good. One for our listeners to watch out for then. Well, I think that's a nice place to end the interview on a sort of theme to watch for the audience. But before we go, I've got our quick fire question round. So this is simply a lighthearted way to end the episode, and you can answer in as little as one sentence. So first of all, question one. What is the top mistake investors make, in your opinion?
Giving up. And I say giving up, and it just kind of, I know it's rapid fire, but I say giving up because if you give up too early, when you're in these false positives of whatever signals you're tracking, you've just invalidated all of your work in analyzing that signal.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. Stick it out. Makes sense. Question two. Where do you go for investment or economic insights? Do you read specific publishers, for example?
I think you go directly to the market, right? I mean, I try to just, again, I go back to give voice to math. I think, you know, there's a lot of content and research out there, but I'm always skeptical of most of the things that I read because when I test them, because I'm just a natural skeptic, it ends up not really working. So I'd rather just sort of focus on the areas that matter the most, which is these intermarket relationships documented in these white papers, which is all driven by market forces, not by somebody's opinion.
Yeah, yeah, completely. Okay, question three. What is the most memorable moment from your career to date? Bit of a tricky one, but let's see what you say.
I think the, there's kind of two. I'll give you the two real quick. The flash crash of 2010. The flash crash of 2010, May 6th, I was working at a family office. And I was convinced, I have an email, I was convinced the market was going to crash that day. The reason I was convinced the market was going to crash May 6, 2010 was junk debt was down 6-7%, and the S&P was still down 3% at that point, which didn't make any sense to me. And that's a real classic intermarket relationship. If you have junk debt cratering, which has a higher claim on assets in the capital structure than equities, by definition, equities have to collapse afterwards. So that was a pretty proud moment. And then the 2011 summer crash, I was very adamant on various websites making the case that you'd have a pretty severe decline because of some of these intermarket relationships signaling something was coming. You had the debt downgrade, everyone worried that the euro would no longer exist. The market collapsed, you know, for clients I was running this approach for. They were defensive in treasuries in advance. That was a proud moment because I really did kind of stick my neck out very aggressively. I think I wrote something like 20 articles, 17 of which in the title I said summer crash. And it so happened that the summer crash happened. Whether it was skill or luck, it depends on the day you ask me. Okay, but That was a pretty remarkable period because that in many ways was the catalyst for me getting in the media and kind of keeping getting my name out there to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the flash crash, I mean, it's such a fascinating sort of story and how these series of events actually kind of conspired to give us this unprecedented crash. And it's one that we've covered on the podcast, actually. We spoke to a guy called Liam Vaughan, an investigative journalist for Bloomberg, who's written a book about it. One for our listeners to circle back and listen to. Really fascinating story. Okay, so question four, a top tip for your younger self.
Have more fun. There's this line, right? You can't get the gold without the dragon, right? So if you want to be ambitious, you have to work very hard and you have to get very lucky. And time is a limited resource, right? So fortunately, everything I've kind of worked towards, has now really mattered. Things are picking up from a business perspective, from a personal perspective. But, I sacrificed a lot of years to get to this point. And I think with hindsight, I myself should have enjoyed the journey more, as difficult as the journey was to get that gold and to fight that dragon to get to this point. I think it's important to kind of not regret, trying to enjoy what you're doing rather than just focus on, the end game.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, really solid advice. Okay, so our final question is one that we ask to all guests. It's sort of the Opto question, as it were. On Opto, we're constantly trying to speak to the people that are outperforming the market. So this question revolves around alpha. What is an investor's best source of alpha? And if I can explain that a little bit more, just because I realize it's pretty vague, if you had to narrow it down to one thing, where do you think the great investors derive their outperformance?
I think unequivocally, it's the risk off. And again, I know I have an incentive to say that, but I've always made that point that alpha doesn't come from being up more, it comes from being down less, which is hard to do because again, markets go up more often than not. But this is why I think it's very hard to quote unquote beat the market, because when you're in an environment where the rising tide is there, everything has a moment where it's performing well and it's hard to kind of get alpha. And again, remember, even the definition of alpha is a little bit tricky because it's alpha against, against beta. So which beta is part of that discussion too. But I think in general, the real when you look at the real sort of legendary traders and allocators and investors, yes, a lot of them made short bets or things of that nature. But the reality is, it's the downside where the alpha comes from. And I think if you keep that in mind, that's how you can really generate significant wealth longer term.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great. Well, I think that's the perfect point for us to end. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast, Michael. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just a quick note before we sign off. If you're looking for an easily digestible daily update on the markets, this might be of interest. Opto Updates is our short newsletter sent every day during the trading week, giving you a bulleted list of the top 7 stories from the global stock markets. We've done the hard work for you, highlighting relevant opportunities and trends. And in addition, we'll also keep you notified of any new products, stock reports, or webinars from the Opto world. If you're interested, sign up using the link in the show notes. And thanks also to CoFruition for consulting on and producing the show. Until next time.